Thanks for listening to the Frontiers podcast. If you have a moment before we start, please rate and follow this podcast. It makes a huge difference. The more of you that do this, the more people get to listen. And the more people that get to listen, the bigger platform I'm building for academics to share their research. Thanks so much. Hi there. You're listening to Frontiers, the podcast that explores cutting-edge research from the world's best scientists. I'm Ian Hallett, and in each episode, I interview professors, doctors, and research scientists who are leading authorities in technology, economics, business, politics, the environment, and sociology, so we can learn about the scientific breakthroughs that will redefine our world. Today, I'm delighted to share with you my conversation with Professor Matthew Grimes. Professor Grimes is a professor of entrepreneurship and sustainable futures at Judge Business School, University of Cambridge. Professor Grimes examines how individuals and organizations create, introduce, and sustain positive social change through entrepreneurship. He's a member of the Organizational Theory and Information Systems subject group at Cambridge Judge Business School, academic co-director of the Cambridge Judge Entrepreneurship Center, and current associate editor at the Academy of Management Journal. Our conversation is entirely focused on social entrepreneurship, and I asked Professor Grimes midway through the interview whether social entrepreneurship can be summarized as people using a business as a tool to create social good, and his answer is fascinating. So I leave you with that insight to enjoy this conversation with Professor Matthew Grimes. Professor Grimes, thanks for joining me today.
Yeah, delighted to be on. Thanks for having me, Ian.
So I'm really interested about the concept of social entrepreneurship. So could we start by defining what is meant by social entrepreneurship and how it differs from a traditional view of entrepreneurship?
Yeah, so I define it pretty broadly as commercial market-based methods for solving social and environmental problems. And so in that sense, there's quite a bit of overlap, I think, between that concept and what we might consider to be traditional entrepreneurship. So I think in some ways we can oftentimes make more of this distinction than we need to. Because I think, entrepreneurs in general are clearly trying to create value, right? Not just capture market value or extract value from the economy. So I think in that sense, there's quite a bit of overlap between both the concept of, quote unquote, traditional entrepreneurship and what we might consider to be social entrepreneurship. That said, over the last, 15 years or so in the academic field, and also I think in practice, there's been a lot of conversation about the need to kind of carve out a separate space for entrepreneurs who are specifically trying to, use commercial market-based methods to solve social and environmental problems. And so as you start to dig into some of these distinctions, you start to see, okay, well, there's, to some extent, there are identity related differences. So if you speak to social entrepreneurs, they will tell you that they are different from traditional entrepreneurs. They'll claim those differences and talk about the distinctive motivations that they might have for pursuing what they're doing. Whereas entrepreneurs may indeed have a lot of passion for what they're pursuing, social entrepreneurs will in some ways claim that compassion actually underlies a lot of what they're pursuing. And then in addition, I think it's not just those motivational differences, but the ways in which they orient their strategies and their measurement approaches. So for instance, there are a few different terms we like to use in the field, double bottom line, triple bottom line, people, planet, and profits. This idea that social entrepreneurs are thinking about a broader set of metrics and outcomes that they're looking to deliver against and optimize on. Coming back to whether or not these distinctions are really material or not. I mean, in some ways, I think the distinctions, the differences between social and commercial or traditional entrepreneurship, have been useful and I think mobilizing the field, right? They've been a way to open up space within the economy, within the polity, within society to, start to ask bigger questions about the purpose of business, and even start to raise questions, not just, whether there needs to be this kind of separate space for social entrepreneurs, but what is the purpose of business more generally? And, shouldn't all organizations in some ways care about a double bottom line? Shouldn't all entrepreneurs in some ways be focused on optimizing on these multiple outcomes? At the same time, I mean, when you look at what is it that we actually care about in terms of these differences? And I think there you start to get back, from a pragmatic perspective, you say, well, we care about the impact that these entrepreneurs are having. And in some ways, traditional entrepreneurs can have massive impacts socially and environmentally, both positive and negative. And the same is true for social entrepreneurs. Social entrepreneurs are not they certainly have the capacity to affect society and the environment in both positive and negative ways. And so I think that's what we ultimately care about here is how is it that entrepreneurs are creating these multiple kinds of impacts in the world around them? And if that requires carving out a separate space for, to mobilize these kinds of, social entrepreneurs, great. But at the same time, I think there's a bigger question that this all raises, which is, shouldn't all entrepreneurs in some ways be thinking about these multiple forms of impact?
And where's the idea of social entrepreneurship come from? In my experience, this is a relatively new label of a form of entrepreneurship. I could be wrong about that.
Yeah. So it's a good question. And I guess if we have a few minutes, I might actually take us back a little bit historically to think about the nature of organizations and the ways that they've sort of managed these kinds of multiple forms of impact. So, I mean, if you think about, for instance, prior to the 20th century, there were a few different kinds of organizations that existed, right? There was the state, the church, and, voluntary associations, really. And at that point in time, there was, all of these organizations were ultimately trying to manage not just their financial mission, but also a social mission. And with the rise of industrialization and shareholder capitalism in the 20th century, organizations essentially started becoming increasingly seen as commodities, right, within the financial markets. And so in that way, a social mission matters less than, the organization's returns. And so social mission was also in some ways seen as potentially in conflict with the need to kind of optimize on those financial returns. And you can see this, for instance, I mean, even early in the 20th century, like Henry Ford and, founder of Ford Motor Companies was tried to increase employee wages and provide health insurance to employees. And shareholders were pushing back against some of this because they saw it as ultimately a trade-off between, these kinds of social impacts and the ultimate financial returns of the company. And this kind of tension continued to grow throughout the 20th century. In mid 20th century, around 1953, I think it was. So there in the US, they introduced what is now known as the 501c3 legislation, which kind of carved out the nonprofit sector from the for-profit sector. So you have essentially this kind of sectoral divide where for-profits could essentially try to optimize on, remunerations to shareholders, and the nonprofit sector could optimize on providing benefits to its beneficiaries. And but even with that sort of sectoral division, you still started to see increasing tensions, right? So in the 1970s, for example, that a lot of corporations were adopting, you know, what they called corporate social responsibility, because they started to see, you know, actually we do have these kinds of demands being placed on us from a variety of stakeholders to engage in more than just maximizing remunerations. But you also had, you know, economists like Milton Friedman, and, you know, sort of out of the Austrian economics camp that were claiming, I mean, so Milton Friedman penned an editorial in the New York Times that was, you know, the social responsibility of business is to actually increase its profits, right? So that is its social responsibility, you know, that's it. And to the extent that it engages in more, that's, you know, this undermines its ultimate social responsibility. And so in the 1980s, you see kind of actually an explosion of nonprofits during the Reagan and Thatcher era. And so again, you have, you know, growth in both sectors, but still increasing tensions within those. And so, you know, late in the 90s, there starts to be this growing conversation using the term social entrepreneurship. So, I mean, if you could do a Google Ingram search, and you can see the kind of the usage of these of this word starts to creep way up in the late 90s and into the 2000s. And this was being driven by a few different organizations, including elite universities. So Harvard, Oxford, Stanford all started building out programs around this concept of social entrepreneurship. Ashoka, a large organization in this space based in Washington, D.C., that funds social innovators and social entrepreneurs. A gentleman named Bill Drayton, who founded Ashoka, was pushing forward this kind of concept quite vigorously. And then you also have Muhammad Yunus, the founder of the Grameen Bank, which was, you know, spearheading a lot of the microfinance movement that started also embracing this concept of social entrepreneurship. He wins the Nobel Peace Prize in 2007. And so there's a lot of kind of, there's a catalyzing energy around this concept that has given way to even more growth. So, you know, for instance, since this kind of explosion of interest in the concept, you've seen sort of a spread of this idea. So, for example, there's an organization called B Lab, which is based out of the United States, that has built a variety of different interventions, from the B Corp certification that many of your listeners might have heard of, to benefit corporation legislation, to the B impact assessment as a way to, you know, evaluate the various kinds of impacts within organizations. This has also given rise to impact investing as a large movement within the financial services sector. New legislation has come out. So in the UK, what are called the KICs, or the community interest corporations. In the US, the L3Cs and benefit corporations. In the UK, there's also now growth around what's called the Better Business Act, trying to push again to mobilize not just carving out this sectoral space for social entrepreneurs, but ultimately to say all businesses should be engaged, I think, in sort of managing these multiple bottom lines. But you've also seen some pushback here as well. So, for instance, like Anand Giridharadas, he wrote this book called The Elite Charade of Changing the World, which is, it's a fascinating book. And I think it's also, it has been a point of conversation in Davos and Aspen and all these places where a lot of, you know, these elites who are trying to change the world are gathering on a regular basis. And, the concept of social entrepreneurship has been part of those conversations. And so, there's been a degree of backlash to say, is this really, is this, you know, is this movement around social entrepreneurship, is it really creating pragmatically the impacts that we're looking to see? Or is it just propping up again, once again, sort of the inequalities that we see in the world and, you know, and ultimately acting as some kind of charade? So, you know, that's a bit of the historical background. So I think there's been a long history of organizations wrestling with this sort of need to think about the financial and the social in combination. And social entrepreneurship is one of the latest ways that we're trying to capture this phenomenon and try to mobilize energy around organizations that are doing both simultaneously. So I hope that's helpful.
It's very helpful. Now, is it, when I think about these different things and in big corporations now, so moving beyond entrepreneurship to big corporations or to any kind of existing company, particularly those that are listed on stock markets, there's lots of pressure to showcase their ESG sustainability, corporate social responsibility kind of strategies.
Yeah.
Getting a B Corp label is also very helpful. Getting a MSCI AAA rating is a very helpful thing to do as well. You know, there's lots of these different things that are going on that are pushing organizations to behave more like, I think, your description of a social business, a social entrepreneur-based business. So is it a logical conclusion that in the end, given all of the various forces that are going around in the world at the moment, whether it be climate change or inequality and so on and so forth, that all organizations will adopt the same types of behaviors and the distinction between social entrepreneurship and entrepreneurship will no longer kind of exist?
Yeah, I mean, it's a really interesting question. And there's quite a bit of debate on this, both, I think, at, you know, within the academy and within the polity. So, you know, should all organizations essentially be social entrepreneurs, right? That it's an interesting question. And I think that there are reasons to expect some degree of convergence here, in the sense that I think many companies are indeed realizing that their financial interests are deeply intertwined with societal interests, and that to the extent that they try to separate those out, there can be long-term implications. So to the extent that companies are faced, you know, are focused exclusively on short-term profits or short-term returns, there it's a little bit easier to make the distinction. But then over the longer term, it becomes harder to do so. And I think you're starting to see even technologists and engineers, you know, let's think about OpenAI as an example of this. You know, a good contemporary example of a company that is thinking about the long-term implications of the technology that it's developing, both in terms of the societal benefits that it can bring, and also the societal harms that it could raise, and trying to think about governance and think about mission in ways that I think are quite similar to what we have observed, for instance, in the kind of conversations around social entrepreneurship that we've been having over the last 15 years. And so I think to the extent that organizations adopt that longer term thinking, there's reasons to expect a degree of convergence. On the other hand, you know, that raises another question, which is that desirable? Is that ultimately what we want? Do we want all organizations to look the same in terms of their governance and their behaviors? And, you know, there I'm a little bit, you know, it's an empirical question, but I'm somewhat skeptical, because I think that variation and diversity in systems is typically a good thing. I mean, when you look at ecosystems, biological ecosystems, social systems, economic systems, diversity generally outperforms homogeneity. And so to the extent that we see organizations looking more and more similar, I think that this can raise additional risks around the resilience of the overall system. And so on the one hand, I'm a champion of the sort of social entrepreneurship kind of approach, but on the other hand, I want to acknowledge that homogeneity in organizational forms may actually not be what we want to see in the future.
It seems to me that, and tell me if I'm oversimplifying this, is that if it's a pure social entrepreneurship based venture, it's like the person that is creating that organization is using the business as a tool to solve a bigger problem that's non-financial. And a byproduct of that is that they generate some cash and they can choose to reinvest that cash and make it a nonprofit or keep that cash to do whatever they need to do for the companies that support it. Am I being too simplistic in the way that I'm describing that?
So that social entrepreneurs see their organizations as a tool for generating these kinds of social returns and environmental impacts. Yes, although I mean I think if you I think in theory that's true. I think in practice, if you were to talk to a social entrepreneur, there's still a degree to which they are treating those organizations as an end in and of themselves. In other words, like I think all entrepreneurs get wrapped up in building something and in the organization itself, and their identities become connected to those ventures. And so, you know, the question of like, I had a professor once talk about, that social entrepreneurs should be in the business of putting themselves out of business, right? That you should, if your ultimate goal is to solve these social problems, that the business should go away after it solves those problems. Obviously, that's not what happens, right? I mean, these organizations expand their prerogatives, right? They look for growth. It's true. I mean, these business is a vehicle, but I also think that that's true for entrepreneurs as well, right? I mean, these businesses are a means to creating value in the world. They're also a means for maximizing shareholder wealth. So these organizations are instruments, but at the same time, they also, in some ways, become ends in and of themselves, right? Where they are deeply connected to the identities of the founders.
Do you have any great examples of companies that are founded on the basis of, you know, by a social entrepreneur that you can share with us just to bring it to life a little bit?
Yeah. I mean, so there's several good examples. I mean, I think probably most listeners would be familiar with Muhammad Yunus and Grameen Bank. So I'll maybe skip that one because I think that's, you know, it's almost like overly used. But it's an interesting one because we can look at it as a foundation for another similar venture, which was built on top of Grameen Bank. So Iqbal Qadir was an entrepreneur in Bangladesh that actually founded Grameen Phone on top of Grameen Bank, which was Muhammad Yunus's microfinance venture. And you know, some of your listeners might not be familiar with Grameen Phone, but it's a very interesting story of social entrepreneurship, of how technology can be harnessed to empower communities, especially in rural areas. And so, so Grameen Bank, of course, was transformed microfinance by giving small loans to the poor without needing collateral, right? And it wasn't just about money. Again, it was about empowering people to lift themselves out of poverty. And so then Grameen Phone came into the picture And it was this kind of revolution in communication for Bangladesh. And so it was about connecting the unconnected. So they realized that if people in remote areas could access communication services, it could dramatically improve their lives. So they had this kind of, one of the things they did was this village phone program. So they actually provided loans to rural women who were already clients of Grameen Bank to then buy mobile phones and then offer telecommunication services in their villages. So because phones at that time were still out of reach for a lot of people, farmers in Bangladesh. And so basically converting phones from product to service and selling it as kind of microtransactions enabled people to achieve connectedness at a time in which mobile phones were still a bit too expensive. And then it also was empowering these women to then essentially create these kinds of franchises, micro franchises, so a woman in a remote village who never had access to that technology suddenly becomes the hub of communication for her entire village, right? So it was empowering for these women and, of course, transformative for the villages as well. As phones have lowered in price, the Grameen phone has started to think, also differently about its business model. So they had this recent kind of initiative called the Connected Cow Initiative, where it's part of a smart farming strategy, right? So farmers can attach these devices to their cows and monitor their health and reproductive status. And so the tech enables these farmers to manage their livestock better, leading to more productivity and income. So, I mean, it's an interesting story, and I think it's a useful story from a social entrepreneurship perspective because it shows the ways that ecosystems are really important, right? It's not just social entrepreneurship is not just about the venture. It's about the kind of ecosystem of ventures and villages and partnership networks that are really essential for developing the space. And so I think a lot of times it's really easy to talk about entrepreneurship from the perspective of a founder or from the perspective of a venture. But ultimately, I think it's really important to be thinking about systems more broadly when we think about social entrepreneurship. I could provide other examples too, but I don't know if you want some more examples or.
No, that's a great example. What I wanted to go to next is it harder for a social entrepreneur to get their venture off the ground when compared to a more traditional entrepreneurial venture? And the reason for the question is that it seems to me that, a lot of these kind of entrepreneurs will get angel investing to start off with, and then they'll move up the hierarchy to venture investing and all those things. So there seems to be an abundance of capital out there to start the next social media app or, electric car company or whatever it is that people are doing. Do social entrepreneurs find it harder to get their things off the ground? Is there enough backing in the financial markets in order to help them?
I would say increasingly so, but at the same time, these are high risk assets, right? In terms of financial markets, and I mean, ventures in general are high risk assets, and so what's happening globally around capital markets means that more generally at this point in time, venture unless you're perhaps an AI company right now, there are few real bright spots in capital raising around for ventures, and that's true for social ventures. But I mean, to your broader question of like, is it different for social ventures? Are there distinctive barriers that social ventures face relative to traditional entrepreneurs? The funding. So unlike traditional, businesses which focus primarily on profit generation, social enterprises have to balance their social mission and financial sustainability. And so, you know, they're often relying on a mix of grants and donations and revenue from sales. And that mix can on the one hand be unpredictable and unstable, right? So making long-term financial planning challenging, so that you're having to manage a variety of different sources of funding. There's other barriers beyond funding. So measuring social impact, for example. So unlike traditional businesses where success is typically measured in financial terms, social enterprises need to quantify their social and environmental impacts. And so this requires developing and implementing, you know, a lot of effective metrics, which can be daunting and resource intensive tasks. From a market awareness perspective, that's also a significant challenge. So, you know, educating the market about the value and importance of their social and environmental mission can be a steep uphill battle. So unlike traditional businesses where marketing might focus mainly on the product or service itself, social enterprises also are having to communicate that kind of broader impact and mission. And that's it's sometimes a complex message to convey. Regulatory hurdles can be an issue. So social enterprises often operate in areas that might not have clear regulation or, you know, may face bureaucratic red tape, especially if they're innovating in new or untested areas. So that can be a challenge. And this is something where I've done some research on, but to the extent that social entrepreneurs are trying to grow and scale their ventures, growth can sometimes have this strange relationship with mission. So as you're trying to expand the reach and impact of what you're doing, it can also create tendencies towards what some have called mission drift. So scaling a social enterprise, trying to maintain the integrity of its mission, it's a delicate balancing act. As they scale, social entrepreneurs have to ensure that their impact is growing proportionately and the quality of their intervention, you know, doesn't diminish. So these would be some of the ways that social entrepreneurs, I think, face, you know, some different kinds of barriers. There are some efforts in different countries, for example, where, you know, there different governments are trying to create incentives for organizations that are pushing their organizational forms explicitly in this direction of trying to manage multiple bottom lines. But that can be challenging to maintain at within countries. So because just as it's difficult for entrepreneurs to measure their multiple forms of impact, it's also difficult for regulators to enforce these kinds of multiple forms of impact. So how, you know, if you're going to create incentives for organizations to become social entrepreneurs, how do you audit that, right? How do you audit the fact that ultimately organizations are indeed pursuing these multiple forms of impact, such that they receive these tax incentives, for example? There are many different challenges that social innovators face at this point in time.
Yeah, this is getting to the crux of what I was hoping to get to in this conversation. So I'm a strong believer that businesses should be and can be and indeed are a force for good. And there are a lot of problems in the world that if an organization mobilized around the problem, I think actually they could get solved faster than if you were relying on a government or even a nonprofit area to try and solve it. So removing these barriers for me feels like a really important thing that governments should be thinking about. By the way, I also know and think that businesses can be a force for bad too. So I'm not saying that it's all perfect, but I'm saying that they could be orientated that way. So if you were advising a government to say, you know, that wanted to bring this type of entrepreneurship into the mainstream, that it was a really big part of capital investment, of resource allocation and so on, what types of things would you be suggesting that they do?
Yeah. I mean, you know, I think there's a couple ways that, I mean, of course there's the simple approaches around creating certain tax incentives. And so there are certain countries that have tried to do that. France, they can benefit from, for example, reduced VAT and you know, VAT rates and have some tax exemptions. And that extends to kind of various sectors, including employment, social housing, and elderly care. The UK has these specific legal forms for social enterprises like the CICs, which can benefit from improved tax treatment. You know, Canada is another example. They don't currently offer specific tax incentives for social enterprises, but there's ongoing discussion and advocacy for implementing these kinds of measures. And you know, the other thing too here is, you know, about procurement policies. I mean, this is another big one. So, I mean, we know that countries, governments can mobilize sectors, not just by way of shifting the measures around tax and tax treatment, but also because government is a huge customer within most economies. And so thinking about the ways that governments can partner with these organizations to help them scale, to help them overcome some of the liabilities of newness that, you know, face any and all organizations. So these are some ways. And I, you know, the procurement policy angle is an interesting one because it allows for, you know, there are ways of designing it in a more kind of personalized, customized way, as opposed to broad policy reform. So you can think about specifically the kinds of organizations that you're wanting to help scale and engage in those kinds of procurement efforts to help mobilize this space. So those would be the more obvious, I think, approaches to help kind of enhance activities in this sector.
And then switching now to the people that want to create a social enterprise, have you seen any patterns of how people go about it and that tend to be more successful than others that would be useful for people to hear and learn? One of the, you know, good ways of going about doing this.
Yeah. It's a good question. You know, I mean, I think, so I it's interesting because I teach and I interact with a lot of entrepreneurs, some of whom again, consider themselves to be social entrepreneurs, some of them who never use that term, but in fact are engaging in kinds of social related activities. And I think we've seen over the last 15 years or so, around the same time that social entrepreneurship has grown, there's been a simultaneous growth in conversations around, for example, lean startup, the idea that organization, you know, entrepreneurs should engage in this kind of agile, rapid product development efforts and experimentation. In some ways, I've embraced a lot of that in my own teaching as well. And I think that there are some lessons that social entrepreneurs can learn from that. At the same time, I think that there's, you know, I think for anyone looking to enter into the realm of social entrepreneurship, my primary advice is usually slightly different than, you know, just rapid experimentation. And my primary advice is really, you need to deeply understand the community or cause that you aim to serve. And I think this goes beyond market research. It's really about immersing yourself in the community, understanding their needs, their challenges and aspirations. This kind of level of understanding is I think crucial because social entrepreneurship, again, it's not just about offering a product or service. It's about creating meaningful and sustainable change. And so, you know, how is it that social entrepreneurs can really prioritize building relationships and trust? Your stakeholders are not just your customers. They are the individuals and communities whose lives you're aiming to impact. And so building trust within these communities takes time and genuine engagement. And I think in some ways, this comes back to what I was saying earlier about, you know, Anand Giridharadas's critiques of this space is because it's, you know, in some ways, it's been, you know, there, it's easy to kind of look at this activity and see, oh, again, this is about the global north trying to mobilize. It's another form of colonialism here, you know, where we're coming in with our entrepreneurial toolkit, trying to reshape economic development around the world. And I think that is the case if in fact social entrepreneurs are not deeply engaging in these kinds of relationship building and trust building efforts to deeply understand the communities that they're trying to impact. And so it's really important to collaborate and form partnerships. Social issues are complex and often require, you know, collective efforts to address effectively. So building alliances with non-governmental organizations, government bodies, other social enterprises. This comes back to what I was saying earlier about, you know, the importance of ecosystems, right? It's not just about the venture. Yes, lean startup experimentation is a tool that can be used in social venturing, but ultimately it's about much more. It's about that relationship building, the ecosystem development that I think allows social ventures to ultimately create the impacts and sustainable impacts that they're looking to achieve.
So I just want to go back 20 minutes ago in our conversation and ask kind of a very direct question. We were talking about OpenAI. Would you consider that to be a social enterprise in the way that it's behaving?
Yeah. So this might be controversial to say. I'm sure there are colleagues of mine that would completely disagree with this statement. But I believe that it's a misconception that you have to. That unless you call yourself a social entrepreneur and spend time in social entrepreneurship related communities, you can't be a social entrepreneur. I think, again, if we take this definition of using commercial market-based methods to solve social problems, then clearly OpenAI and a lot of other companies that we would not typically categorize as a social innovator or social entrepreneur are in fact social entrepreneurs, whether they call themselves or not, right? They're operating in a distinctive way. They have a distinctive set form of governance. They're thinking differently about the measures and metrics that they use. And so, yes, I mean, I do believe they are. Now the question is, how do we ensure that social entrepreneurs more generally, including OpenAI, are able to, you know, how do we hold them to account to produce those positive impacts that they claim to be trying to pursue? And how do we hold them to account to ensure against the potential liabilities or social costs that that their ventures might create in the world? And again, I think that just because you call yourself a social entrepreneur doesn't make you immune to creating negative impacts in the world, right? So in all of these cases, whether it's OpenAI, other forms of social innovators, social entrepreneurs, or organizations more generally, our role as academics, as policymakers, as stakeholders of these ventures is to hold them accountable to creating real value in the world and not just extracting value.
Yeah, it's really interesting. I was listening to an interview with Sam Altman, the CEO of OpenAI, a couple of days ago, and he was asked about how he felt about the fact that nearly his entire organization signed a petition requesting him to rejoin after he was fired. And, you know, the question was about him being a great CEO. His response was really interesting, and it wasn't about me. They all joined because there's a mission that we're on, which is to safely deploy general AI to the world for good. So the people were worried about the mission was going to stop, not about coming to join me.
Yeah, but it is interesting though, because it was it's a tension between Sam Altman in some ways and the venture capital investors that are funding a lot of the growth. and the nonprofit board that has that is really in place to hold in check and hold the management accountable to that very goal. And so, you know, yes, it's about the mission, but so is the nonprofit board was trying to uphold that mission as well when they decided to push him out. So, the question is, can we truly hold these organizations accountable when they're pushed towards this kind of rapid exponential growth through competitive markets and through venture financing? These are real open questions at the moment, but I think responsible entrepreneurship, that's really where I hope this conversation of social entrepreneurship starts to push more towards, because I see questions of responsible entrepreneurship is actually perhaps even more important than the motivational identities of whether or not you're a social entrepreneur or a traditional entrepreneur.
This has been a really fascinating conversation. I am really appreciative of you taking the time to do this. Is there anything else that you think we should cover or any final comments you want to leave for our listeners?
No, that's great. I really appreciate the opportunity to speak to you and your listeners. I guess maybe I'll just leave with this one statement. So, you know, I think the world is kind of full of paradoxes, these kinds of trade-offs, and social entrepreneurship is this phenomenon that has at its core a paradox between social and financial goals and impact. And our default within our minds and sometimes even within society is to try to separate these goals, which we find competing, and it allows us to kind of resolve ambiguity that we might feel. But I think these paradoxes can oftentimes be generative for ourselves, for the world around us. And so when you combine social and financial goals, for instance, I think it opens up all kinds of new creative opportunities that you might not have seen before. So thanks again for this opportunity, Ian. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. Thanks again. Thank you so much for listening. To support this podcast, please follow it on whatever platform you're using. It makes a huge difference. Thank you again. Hope to see you next time.